Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I've been the chairperson as well as the presenter. We don't have a chairperson, so we're looking after ourselves. My name is Michael Coghlan. I come from Australia, like a lot of people at this conference. I don't work in a university, so I do not have to publish papers to get up the chain in my life, but I decided to publish a paper because I wanted to come to this conference. I have friends here in Lisbon, and I also think the topic that I chose to present on needs to be heard. And as you would see in the program, and you probably read, it's about a book that was released last year called The Internet and What It's Doing to Our Brains by a man called Nicholas Carr. Before I talk about that book and its impact on me, this was 4 days ago in Jordan. I took the opportunity to spend a few days in Jordan on my way here, half an hour from the airport, in the middle of the desert, just south of Amman, is this man sitting on a mat at 6 o'clock in the morning on Skype, on the internet. And I just thought, what an amazing world. So I just wanted to be very clear that I agree with everything Alec Kouros said yesterday. I love the internet. I love what it can do for people all over the planet. I consider myself to be a network educator. I'm a network teacher. I'm a network learner. So I'm on the right team. But this book, I'll just go back to this view, came out around June last year. And I read it because I couldn't stop it. The back of the book says, I challenge you, read a book. Read a book from start to finish. Walk away from this and read a book. So I took on the challenge. And I also took on the challenge of writing a paper for this conference because it's not something I normally do, nor do I normally read a book. Why he wrote this book is that he became aware that he was having trouble reading books. He was having trouble reading long, complicated, in-depth academic journals. He recognised there was a change in how he was behaving and how he was processing information. When I read this book, I just kept thinking, yes, yes, yes. I didn't want to admit it. People do not want to admit it. When I shared with my network that I had been impressed by this book, my network didn't want to know. Oh, he's a journalist. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's making extreme statements. People do not want to engage with what this man is saying. I think we should be engaging with what he is saying.
If I go back for me, so please come back. Okay. So this woman is reading. I found her on the beach near my home one day. She's not there for 5 minutes. She's kind of nestled into the rock. She's going to be there for a long time. She hasn't got a phone. She's settled down for a long time. She's going to read. I became aware for the first time, and the idea has come back to me in recent times, that when I was in my 20s and I was doing my undergraduate studies in history, I was very taken by this book, which was a history book about the medieval period called The World We Have Lost. And the way the narrative was presented in this book struck me at the time, changes about losing things. It's not just change, it's about gaining things. For everything we gain, we lose something. So Peter Laslett asked this about modern history. Carr is asking the same question about where we are in the history of humanity, and particularly with relation to thinking and learning. I was also taken by a guy called Larry Sanger, who was a co-founder of Wikipedia. The more famous and well-known person who's responsible for Wikipedia is Jimmy Wales, but right there at the beginning was Larry Sanger, so he's one of the insiders, he's one of the choir, he's a network person. He stood outside of network learning for a while and decided there were deep questions that needed to be asked and answered There were a whole lot of assumptions going on in internet and learning that were not being challenged. And if I had one issue with something of what Alec was talking about yesterday, though I agree with it and I loved it, I think that it is based on a whole lot of assumptions which we need to examine more closely. You will hear people say that memorization is not necessary now because it's all on the internet. Sanger says rubbish. He says you don't need individual learning now, it's about learning in groups. Collaboration is the thing. Sanger says not true. Books, gone, network constructed knowledge together with your peers, this is the way of the future. Maybe to what extent is the question. We'll return to these shortly. Let's just get that out of the way. We know new technology inspires fear of change. It always has, it always will. People freak out. It's new, it's changing. My God, the telephone's going to ruin people's lives. We will never want to meet anymore. Well, we did. The telephone certainly changed our lives. This book of Nicholas Carr is full of stories, of stuff you have probably never thought of. I certainly hadn't. An example he gives of people being afraid of technology, probably a fairly well-known one, is way, way back after the invention of writing, Socrates and other people at the time feared the end of the oral tradition. They feared a consequent reduction in their intellectual capacity. They were right about one thing. It certainly killed the oral tradition. How many of you now can recite the Aeneid or an epic poem that's 10 pages long? Or can tell a story that goes for an hour and a half, which was back then quite common. That's what we did. We remembered things and we talked at length because the oral tradition was how we transmitted knowledge to our peers and to younger and future generations. So writing killed the oral tradition. Did it kill our intellectual capacity? Probably not. When we first started reading, apparently, people read out loud. Bishop of Milan in the year 380 AD apparently is one of the first people on record to be noticed as he read silently. He sat in a room on his own and read silently and people thought he was unnatural. They didn't like it. What are you doing? And of course the idea caught on. And Carr talked at some length about what happens. Imagine that difference between reading a text out loud and reading a text to yourself is that you're reading in silence. It frees your mind for contemplation, reflection, introspection, and maybe even, he says, the birth of abstract thought. You can't do these things when you're reading aloud. The idea of reading silently actually frees the brain to operate in this whole other realm. I just put this little anecdote in here about Samuel Johnson because it's an interesting one. Another thing you will hear about these days, you don't need to know anything, you just need to know where to get it. It's true to a point, but Samuel Johnson apparently in the 16th century went visiting someone who had a library, and as soon as he got to the house he disappeared into the library and started walking up and down the shelves of the library looking at the books this man had. And the man, the host of Dr. Johnson, what are you doing? He said, I'm just checking what you've got, because there are two kinds of knowledge. There's the knowledge you have in your head, and there's the knowledge you need to have about where it is when you need it. And so Samuel Johnson, way back in the 16th century, was already on to this idea about knowing where to get knowledge. Not a new idea. Central to Carr's, I'm not going to call it a thesis, but his argument in his book is this new notion, relatively new notion of neuroplasticity. As someone said, we used to just call it learning. Neuroplasticity is what's going on in our brains as we learn, as we go about our lives. And we now know that when we do things, our brain, this wonderful organ, accommodates change. And it will do until the day we die, as long as we have a healthy, functioning brain. If I decide to learn a new language tomorrow, my brain will accommodate me. If I decide to take on a new musical instrument tomorrow, my brain will accommodate that. And the more I do it, if I decide to learn Portuguese, I put myself in that every day, for weeks and months, put myself in that place, what the brain does is form neural pathways. It makes new connections in our brain, and the more we do that activity, the thicker, physically thicker, those connections get, and the easier it is to do learning Portuguese. What's also going on in the brain at the same time is that it's not an infinite resource, the brain. It's reallocating resources. So when I'm learning Portuguese, I used to live in Holland, so I learned Dutch. It would be taking away resources from Dutch. He's not using Dutch anymore. It would be putting them in Portuguese. So my brain is working like this all the time, reallocating, rewiring. So when it comes to things like multitasking, that thing that we often do where we're looking at our email, we're looking at our phones, we're looking at it up on the screen, we're jumping from different points of focus to other points of focus, we're engaging in a kind of mental activity which the brain is accommodating. And we've become, many of us, and people say, of course, the idea is that young people in particular are wonderful at multitasking. Well, they may well be, because the brain is accommodating that, and it is creating neural pathways that makes that easier. But what the brain is always also doing at the same time, and the big comparison that Carr makes, is that you might be finding it, the more you multitask, the harder you find it actually read a book. It's just reality. If you're spending all your mental time over here working this way, if you come back over here, you're going to struggle. So that's a central part of his argument. He also says, but this is kind of old Marshall McLuhan type information about media, but Carr uses this phrase, the intellectual ethic. Every technology brings with it an intellectual ethic. It brings messages that this medium transmits into the minds and cultures of its users. But put simply, it changes us. It just does. There's no argument about technology changes us, it's how it changes us. He refers to the internet as a culture of distraction. He said if you wanted to set about creating something that was the epitome of something which would distract you, you'd create the internet. An extreme statement, but he goes into all of these examples about multitasking. Let's start with multitasking. I mean, it does encourage you to multitask. It turns out multitasking is impossible. What we can do is switch tasks very quickly from one to the other. So this very common statement that women can multitask, men can't, it's rubbish. It's simply not true because women can't multitask. Our brains cannot accommodate it. What women may well do is switch tasks faster than men can, but it's neurologically impossible for a brain to multitask. However, if you have 5 tasks to achieve, and you set yourself a week, say 5 days, 5 tasks, what I think a lot of us do, I certainly do, sometimes I train myself to stop it, I'll do a bit of task 1, then I'll do task 3, task 4, email comes in about task 5, I get a Twitter about task 4, phone call about task 2, I think I'll go back to 1, and I'll juggle those 5 tasks in the course of the week, and at the end of the week somewhere I've finished them. According to studies quoted by Carr, if you take those same 5 tasks, and you do task 1, finish it. Do task 2, finish it. Do task 3, finish it. And so on, guess what? You complete those 5 tasks more quickly. Your comprehension of what you've done is deeper. And the level to which you have achieved those tasks is significantly deeper. And they've tested this time and time again. It's just true. Right? So yeah, you can multitask. You will reach the same goal eventually, but it's not going to be as efficient. And it won't be to the same depth. Does this matter? That's the question. Hyperlinking, that wonderful thing that we're also used to on the internet, and they've done this again in repeated studies. The results are all the same. I give you 4 people a page of text, electronic, on a screen, no hyperlinks. I give you people the same text with hyperlinks. You're instructed not to follow the hyperlinks, just read the text. These people will read that text more quickly and have a greater level of comprehension and depth of understanding than you every time, even though you don't go to the hyperlinks. Why? Because even though you're not going to the hyperlink, you make a decision. Every time you come to that hyperlink, am I going to go there? No, I'm not. I'm told not to. And you read on. But that interruption, that stop, interferes with the cognitive flow. You leave your train of thought, you jump off for a minute, and you go back. Every time you do that, you lose your train of thought. It takes cognitive effort to get back to where you were before you were thinking about that hyperlink. So I think it's time at the top of every page on the internet, switch hyperlinks on or off. Because if they're off, you're going to be a lot more efficient and have a greater understanding. Guess what else happens when you multitask and jump around flicker minding? I call it flicker minds. Flicker to here, flicker to there, flicker to there, flicker to there. And this is where, and if you read the paper, there's a reference there to a podcast that I came across recently with people in their 20s talking about how they use technology. And in their words, it's addictive. Now, we've suspected this for a while. Guess what happens when you multitask, when you go off to look at an email to see if someone has retweeted you, check a status on Facebook? You get a dopamine hit. Your brain releases a chemical that makes you feel good. That's good. I've been retweeted, or someone's checked my Facebook page, or someone's responded to my email. It makes perfect sense to me because it always felt good. But in fact, it's physically reinforcing the fact that you're multitasking and changing focus. You are getting a dopamine or dopamine hit. No wonder it's addictive. It's minor, it's small, but it's happening. This is always going to happen. Hey, I shouldn't have stayed so long on one. There it is. Yeah. I'll let you just read that for a minute. It's a bit of text, a Clark quote.
It's not able to
multitask. The quiet was part of the meaning, part of the mind, the access of perfection to the page.
Let's get rid of this. If you don't need Internet Explorer, close that and use up the most memory.
Yeah, you might be right. I like to, I'm waiting for this to come up, and it might eventually. Kill. That's something. Trying to do here is get to this slide, which talks about horizontal learning, and I wasn't aware that the phrase had been used elsewhere in a different context. Oh, come on, you silly thing. What's it there? Horizontal learning has been used by other people to describe other things, particularly Etienne Wenger in Community of Practice community, but I decided to use it for this, the multitasking thing, and I like to contrast it with something which is called vertical learning, where you concentrate on something that has, well, you are engulfed and engaged in a single focus. And when I went to university, and here's a kind of, I'm a baby boomer, obviously, you know, I'm well into my 50s. My education was of a particular kind. it was very much characterized for this kind of thing. You were given a topic, you went away for 3 weeks or more, you read many, many books and many, many articles on the same topic. You synthesized all that data, thought deeply about it, and then wrote 5,000 words. That was a very standard procedure. There were times when we hated it. There were times when I thought it was incredibly boring. There were times when I thought, what's the point of all of this? And it's only now that I consider maybe there's a group of people coming through using technology in a very different and an incredible way. As Alex said yesterday, what people are achieving alone together, in that example he gave of people creating music together, is astounding. But could they do this if they had to? And does it matter? Does anyone need to do this anymore? So, I mean, these are rhetorical questions for here now, but these are not rhetorical questions that we should be asking of ourselves and our colleagues and our family and friends when we go back out into the world. I mean, is this what you see going on? I mean, I think it's pretty clear that there's a culture of distraction happening, because we will see five people standing at a bus stop in every single one of them. I mean, maybe that's okay. I don't know. But what Carr says, the bigger, deeper question is this last one. He says maybe the age of the book, so-called, is coming to an end. And maybe that's okay too. And the contemplative, deep, introspective thinking that was associated with that single focus, vertical learning, age of the book type learning, is also coming to an end. And does that matter? Are the skills that we're developing as a result of multitasking and this engagement in multiple devices and network learning, are they the skills we require for life from here on? Or is there a time and place for both? And I guess that's, to come back to Sam, and I think I've got about 5 minutes. Old skills, so-called old skills, memorisation. People say you don't need to memorise anything anymore because it's all on the internet, or you probably know, I'll just check up with you. But to use the example of music, only when you have memorised a piece of music so intently do you understand what that music is capable of. Only then can you interpret that music. Only then can you maybe use that music somewhere else, transfer it to another context. And you don't have any idea about that piece of music, really, until you've internalised it, until you've memorised it. And in the same way that the average academic can stand up in front of a class and talk for an hour about their area of expertise, they've memorised untold facts and bits of data and connections between those data and opinions of that person versus that person, so they can stand and talk for an hour on their area of expertise because they have memorised stuff. Collaboration is wonderful. The short summary of Sanger's objection to collaboration being put forward as the central pedagogy of the internet and the way that internet education must go forward with the new technology, he said, look, ultimately, every one of us has to sit and read and write alone. Or you have to watch that movie alone. Or you have to listen to that audio alone. Because collaboration goes so far, but at some point it comes back, you've got to do it on your own. You can't show me what that movie has to be, or you can't make me see in the same way that I can learn to see it for myself. And it's a similar point, really. The individual at some point has to go back to themselves, shut off from the network and do it themselves. Now, there's a woman in India, her name is Geeta Narayanan, and for some years now she has been working with people on the outskirts of Bangalore and using technology, yes, but with a great deal of qualification. And she has been absolutely quite clear in saying that we need to consciously embrace the core value of slowness. And she says the culture of immediacy that values fast knowledge, which in turn runs counter to the development of both self and the mind. And she's very interesting to read. And I mean, you could argue with, okay, well, that she's dealing with poor people in the outskirts of Bangalore, that's for them. But when I read Geeta Narayan, and I just think, again, I just think she's right. But, you know, I'm 55 plus. Maybe it's just me who's feeling these things, because I'm aware of something else. I know I did something else. I know that I've changed. And I know there are young people, well, I don't know, my suspicion is there are people coming through under the age of 30 who've never had that kind of liberal education that I have, which enables me to operate in different spheres. Now, if you get the chance, this is an amazing little screen, it's a video using Screener, which Alec referred to yesterday, from Howard Rheingold, who's been around on the internet and education from the beginning. He was the man who wrote at length about online community back in the late 90s. And this little movie, it's about a minute long, shows Howard Rheingold going through Twitter, that's an interesting link, goes to that link, scans it, finds the passage that he thinks is relevant to him, copies, pastes it, brings it over into this other bit of software, a bit like Mendeley that George Siemens referred to yesterday, where he's got the draft of a book he's writing. And he just does a quick search for the key point or the topic that he wants to put this text in, and takes that text, drops it into the middle of the paragraph on that particular point, saves, and then goes back to work. Now this is an advanced brain at work. Now this is the brain of someone who was brought up the same way that I was brought up. He's able to go to Twitter like that and incorporate that distraction into something which is incredibly substantial and solid and cognitively demanding. But I wonder how many, you know, I just wonder how many of us can do it. So that's a great example of how you can use the new technology and the culture of distraction to produce something which is a very, very solid academic document. So, I think we should go offline sometimes, I guess. I can't believe I'm saying it. I think the questions the car needs, but we just need to ask ourselves that and just be aware of this question, because something will be going. There's no argument about that. And we can all have that discussion with each other and with colleagues and family about what is going on and what are we losing and does it matter. That's all. Thank you for listening.